This recording is the property of the Winogrand Foundation. It cannot be used, quoted, transcribed, or otherwise rebroadcast without the express permission of the Foundation. This is New York Academy of Sciences at the Winogrand Foundation Lecture Series for February 10th, 2014. Becky Schultes and Re-Registering Moroccans.
Dr. Schultes speaks an impressive array of languages and dialects herself: Standard Arabic, Moroccan Arabic, Lebanese Arabic, French, Biblical Hebrew, and Classical Greek. Dr. Schultes is a recipient of a fellowship from the American Council of Learned Societies in 2010, as well as numerous grants and fellowships as a graduate student at the University of Arizona, where she earned her PhD in 2009. Her current research, the theme of her talk this evening, examines how Moroccan television producers are adapting older language genres such as storytelling to modernizing projects in Morocco. The title of her talk is Re-Registering Moroccans, Mediatized Temporalities and the Politics of Recognition and State Storytelling. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Becky Schultes.
Well, thank you for all coming out this evening. I first want to thank Janice for inviting me to come and speak, and Sonia for graciously serving as discussant. But lastly, the weather gods for allowing this not to be canceled, as every other event for the last couple of Mondays has happened. It's amazing. The snow has been quite phenomenal. I'll be reading most of my talk and pointing to the slides at various points. I'm going to start with a vignette. It was tea time, and Aisha's mother had laid in the small table with pastries, bread, olives, boiled eggs split in half and sprinkled with salt and cumin. As she poured tea and coffee for us all, the television in the corner contributed an additional voice to the multiple conversations that ebbed and flowed, sometimes demanding the attention of the whole group, at other moments a soundtrack backgrounding our crosstalk. As a promotional commercial for a Turkish dramatic serial began, Aisha asserted to me that everyone watches Turkish soap operas in Morocco these days. Of course, now they're dubbed into Moroccan Arabic with Moroccan Arabic dialogues. When I asked her about recent dramatic serials based on Morocco's fabled past, like Romano Abortal or Hadiden, she admitted she didn't watch them. She worked too much at the garment factory and didn't have time. She quickly followed her admission by asserting that Moroccans, both young and old, like the serials, though, because they brought to life that which people no longer experience: Moroccan life in the past, the way they used to talk in proverbs and stories to teach wisdom and morality. She felt that the new generation no longer understood these proverbs without surrounding context to give them clues. Even though she had framed our discussion by revealing that she did not watch these Moroccan historical dramas, she assertively stated that the thing she liked the most about them was the way they talked in rhymed prose, or what she called ritm al-wazn, or as others have called it, hadra al-mizan, a measured kind of speech. She then made the following near lament about the value of that way of speaking. This is a picture of the salon area. That might make it easier to see. And as you can see, the Arabic is on the right. In the middle is a transliteration, and on the left is an English translation. So she said, the old folks were more clever than us because their speech was with melody and rhythm, with wisdom and melody. For Aisha, rhymed prose, the linguistic form in which Moroccans of an older era conveyed proverbs, stories, and other wisdom literature, indexed or pointed to the superior communicative skills of those who used them. Since she set this within a discussion about the use of rhymed prose in a new wave of Moroccan television serials, she connected a nostalgic valence from one communicative medium, face-to-face interaction, to another, television. She did so using both an emblematic register, icon — she had a term for it, ritm al-wazn, she had a specific way of talking about it — a chronotopic envelope, a space-time envelope, indexing speakers associated with this way of speaking, the old folks, nas qadam, and a positive evaluative stance toward the register and its speakers, dikiyin alayna. They were much wiser than, or more clever than we. Notice that she did so after explicitly stating that she had not watched episodes of this television program herself, but relied on chains of circulating talk about it. She may have also caught promotional ads displayed in these moments of interaction when the television served as backdrop to social visits, meal routines, and family life, but she did not state this explicitly. I suggest, based on my observation of media use over time, that Aisha demonstrated an implicit ideology about what media is and does. One can know and connect this way of speaking without actually connecting, without actually watching contemporary manifestations of this register in a televisual medium. How might messaging work when a socially significant storytelling register shifts participation framework from the dynamic influence of live face-to-face interlocutor feedback to the simultaneous point-to-mass dissemination of a pre-filmed product for an imagined audience? I wish to suggest ways we might analyze implicit and explicit media ideologies of producers and viewers when a commodified register changes mediums and participant frameworks. I suggest that we need to pay more attention to the ways that implicit and explicit media ideologies can be created through indexical bundling. The linking of different sensorial qualities and their possible meanings when they are embedded in particular specific manifestations. And here I'm building on the work of Webb Keane, who has maybe a good example of this, if you're not familiar with Webb's work, is the idea of red. Red, we don't know what it fully means unless it's embodied in a particular manifestation, for example, a red apple. But when it becomes a part of a red apple, it then takes on other indexical qualities like roundness and crispness and potentially sweetness, right, depending on all of these kinds of indexical bundlings. So part of what I'm suggesting here is that these deep meanings, and this is a gloss that the Moroccans that I talked to about this register, about this way of speaking, they call this a way of speaking that conveys deep meanings. So for these Moroccans, what does deep meaning, what does it mean, what does it associate with, when manifest in an endangered oral register associated with wisdom, heritage, street performance, a nostalgic past, and real-time audience response? That is then linked to a mass mediatized medium and product that assumes an indexical selectivity, right? There's a specific audience that this particular product is marketed for. Undereducated Moroccan audience in need of civic reform and inexpensive entertainment. How might participant frameworks affect the indexical bundling possibilities? For example, public street storytelling involve face-to-face interactions where participants orient to each other's gaze, posture, vocal quality, dress, and speech content to determine their response to an ongoing emerging event. Whereas television dramas can be oriented to as a participant in a family interaction, but the film product does not respond to its interlocutors in the viewing moment. Thus, producers create their storytelling with an imagined viewer in mind. The indexical bundling of specific registers with specific participant frameworks and media qualities can lead to expectations about the role of media in shaping kinds of people. We can enrich our understanding of these semiotic processes by analyzing entailments that emerge from the implicit and explicit media ideologies of producers and consumers in relation to register use in specific medias and genres. I'm building on the work of linguistic anthropologists who are currently connecting, in a very fruitful way, language ideologies or expectations about what language is, does, or should do with media ideologies, expectations people have about what a medium is, does, or should do. And here I'm thinking of the work that Alana Gershon has done and others in 2010 and subsequently. Alana nicely summarized in ways in which media and language ideologies differ as semiotic ideologies. They may mutually constitute each other and yet not easily align when examined in specific ethnographic contexts because media and language ideologies involve different material limitations in their communicative channels. And like language ideologies, they can be multiple, partial, positioned, and contested. Asif Aga has also talked about this concept of mediatization, which is a subset of mediation much larger. Mediatization links forms of communication to processes of commodification. Both public market storytelling and television dramatic serials are mediatized as commodified language, set within layers of other communicative contexts that evaluate their success and or valorize their worth. However, the mechanisms for doing so differ, including the erasure of the labor involved in creating a consumable communicative product. This presentation tells the story of one such process, the mobilization of this old language form, hadral mizan, or rhymed prose, for new messages via television rather than street venues. I explore what a specific Moroccan producer sought to accomplish and what some members of the intended audience articulated as their point through interviews and observations of viewing events. As glossed to me by several viewers and a producer of a state-sponsored dramatic serial, Hadral Mizan, or this rhymed prose, indexed the storytelling styles of an older generation in which deep meanings were attached to rhymed prose. Thus, both this producer and actual viewers had one shared indexical value for the register, among others. As state-sponsored producers recontextualize this rhyme prose form from oral face-to-face context to media, mass mediated multimodal venues, they drew on previous positive associations while attempting to accelerate new understandings of modern Moroccan civic personhood. They employed elements and associations from previous register usage, such as the morality inherent in proverb sound parallelisms, but altered the content and context to shape new citizen values, such as respect for diversity, the ineffectiveness of magic, or how to use cleverness to succeed by merit in a world marked by uneven and often unstated status distinctions. So the one I'm going to be talking about tonight is a program producer who explicitly revalorized the idea of the clever Moroccan trickster. Moroccan audiences participated in this enregisterment process, this creating of a register, through what is known as television talk, right? This meta-linguistic talk about what they're doing. Despite the producer expectations that rhymed prose would lend authority to the modernizing content, the Moroccan viewers I encountered expressed nostalgic appreciation that their heritage was being preserved rather than a demonstrable adoption of the state media's modernization narrative. I offer a partial description of this process through the ways in which a Moroccan storytelling style associated with grandmothers and street performers is being revalorized or re-registered through mass mediation to fit the modernizing needs of state television. So Moroccan television has always been a state-sponsored venture. Their first station began broadcasting in 1962, not long after Moroccan independence from France in 1956, and adhered to the prominent media as modernization ideology. I heard this orientation in my interviews and observations of several Moroccan media producers. In media as modernization view, television's primary purpose was to socialize a modern citizenry through programs that taught literacy, civic participation, and modern values. A public-private partnership created a second television station in 1989, known as Duzem. The first station is known as Al Oula, the first. Duzem is the second. With the advent of satellite television in the 90s, an explosion of private and national stations began to compete with Moroccan state television. In response to this, Moroccan television expanded to include a bouquet of special interest stations, which in 2013 included the primary station, Al Oula, Duzem, an educational channel, the third channel, a Quranic channel, a channel for Moroccans living abroad, and a channel for southern, quote-unquote, Morocco, Layoun. In 2005, the king, Mohammed VI, confirmed that television was a key element to the government's development goals. Thus, television began as, and continued through 2013, to be public service television that some argue promotes the value of urban elites. The idea of television as educational tool was one of the several media ideologies expressed by many Moroccans when I asked them what they thought Moroccan television's purposes should be. Thus, the media and modernization ideology was a shared one. However, as with all ideologies, it was situationally salient and tied to specific program genres for most viewers. And I'll talk about this in just a minute. So, UNESCO recognized the loss of public storytelling in Marrakesh's famous Jemaa el Fna by deeming it an intangible cultural heritage of humanity in 2003. Though efforts for its reclamation had begun earlier by European culture makers, as well as by Moroccan state-sponsored filmmakers and cultural associations. The initial state redeployment of public storytelling came in the 1980s via Taïb al-Alaj's popular afternoon radio theater, Al-Azaliya, The Eternal Tale. This is a picture of Taïb al-Alaj, who just recently passed away. And this is, there are several of his radio programs you can actually listen to now on YouTube. People have been posting recordings of them. He was famous among Moroccans for using Hadr al-Mizan, this rhymed prose, to animate Moroccan versions of evocative tales from Arab oral heritage. The magic of rural life, the wise wanderer enchanting the sultan's court, the moral merchant's travails and triumphs, and the mortal female trickster. Many Moroccans I spoke to remember fondly the imaginative flights woven by Alage's oral theatrics. Moroccan state television began to use Hadr al-Mizan as the storytelling format for an adult literacy television program, Alif Lam, which ran from 1999 to 2004. When I began visiting Morocco in the late 90s or and early 2000, my friends and host families recommended I try to improve both my Moroccan Arabic and my modern standard Arabic by watching Alif Lam on Moroccan television. The program utilized well-known Moroccan actress Naima Msharki in the role of older female storyteller who would recount a brief morality tale in Moroccan Arabic, followed by a 10-minute reenactment and a panel of three participants who would write/talk about the story using a specific grammatical feature from modern standard Arabic, or a class of lexical items in modern standard Arabic. The panel of participants included a young boy, a grandfather figure, and a mid-aged woman. The scenic backdrops were homes and village settings, the costuming reflected the historical, mythical Moroccan past, and the Moroccan Arabic stories employed Hadr al-Mizan, this rhymed prose. The program was seen as a highly successful way to situate literacy within indigenous instructional frames and produced over 200 episodes in its five-year run. That's quite a lot of television. As part of the enregisterment process, the language style and settings indexed domestic space and sought to legitimate adult literacy by naturalizing the links between moral teaching and the home as a learning locale for formal schooling. Msharki commented in an interview with the Moroccan Cinema Association that the state had a direct role in identifying storytelling as a lost yet revered domain among Moroccans, one in which fighting illiteracy could best be approached. The interviewer touted the program for returning television viewers to their authentic and true identity through Moroccan Arabic, while teaching the key educational and economic skills of modern standard Arabic. Fatima Ali Boukdi began writing and producing several Moroccan folk heritage films, Tarath al-Shabi, and miniseries using Hadr al-Mizan beginning in 2002. So she started with Taglilin, Aish Dweeba, Amoud, Suknisa, Rumana Wabartal, Hadidan, and a spin-off series of Hadidan called Ensulu Hadidan. We're going to ask Hadidan, this character. In my interview with Boubkadi, she explicitly viewed her mission to preserve the fading Moroccan Berber folk wisdom, fables, and expressive forms, and did so through her historical fantasy productions. When I asked her why she chose an old speech style to convey contemporary ideas, she said, "Measured speech, its rhyme, the melody that exists, it catches a child. Even if he doesn't understand the meaning, he can tell you that it's good speech. He feels it because the measurement is like a song. Even if you don't understand the words, the melody takes you. The alliterative words give a rhyme. The dialogue catches people, even if they don't understand the meanings." Boubkadi articulated a similar ideology to Aisha in the opening vignette. They both felt that people could feel the deep quality of the talk, even if they could not understand the content. She explicitly viewed her work as revalorizing the register, bringing it back to public space, but in this case, a mass-mediated, imagined public, and with stories that imparted contemporary civic values. In particular, her chosen characters modeled fabled women and men in very difficult circumstances, orphaned, left to fend for themselves, born into poverty and of low social rank, who used their cleverness, intelligence, and folk wisdom to achieve ascendancy in their social-spiritual worlds, as well as teach their neighbors through humorous verbal tricks. Her 2011 production, Nsulu Hadidan, was a series of 10-minute episodes contextualizing a Moroccan proverb with a story set in the mythical Moroccan past and ended with a riddle. In good mass media multimodal fashion, the riddle's answer could then be texted via phone to win about 1,000 Moroccan dirhams, about $125. It aired every night during Ramadan, just as people would have been finishing Taraweeh prayers, right? So they would have been finishing, they'd already broken their fast, and they had done the nightly prayers, and they'd come back home to relax before eating again. And each episode was titled, with the proverb being explained, but each proverb was a slight variation on older versions, adapted for more contemporary sensibilities and contexts. For example, one episode illustrated the principle buyer beware, or that people should not buy something simply to demonstrate their financial prowess. Bubkiri took the title from a longer proverb. So this is the episode, Nzulu Hadidin, that I'll be talking about. These are the three different versions of the proverb. So the first is the version of the proverb that ended up in the title of this particular episode. So in this one, it's Matshri Hatatjarab, Matshri Hatatkalab, right? Don't buy until you've tried, or don't buy until you've searched. So this is the idea, again, that to be a good buyer, one has to be engaged in the buying process. Don't just buy something because you can. When I asked people about this proverb, several Moroccans glossed different versions of it for me. So the second one is مَدْرَبْ حَتَتْكَرَّبْ وَمَتَزْرَعْ حَتَتْزَرَبْ وَمَتَسَحَبْ حَتَتْجَرَبْ. So don't punch until you get close, don't plant until you fence, and don't make friends until you test them. So this was the kind of larger proverb, of which she had taken and modified a smaller part. The televisual story began with Hadidan, the main character, who's kind of Joha-like, if you know something about comedic characters in the Arab world, sitting on the ground under a makeshift awning, sharing tea with some of his friends in a rural retrojection of a contemporary cafe setting. This is that screenshot. Hadidan was relating to his friends what an amazing sheep he had to slaughter before, during the coming Eid al-Adha, the Feast of Sacrifice. His poetic description had them all encouraging him to sell it, each besting the other in the amount they would pay for this amazing ram. A Jewish neighbor sitting in another corner of the awning cafe overheard them talking and offered to buy it for more than all the others. The assumption in the story was that the Jews were typed as hagglers and would plan to sell it for an even higher price later on. He wanted to see it first, but Hadidan convinced him to buy it sight unseen. After paying the agreed-upon price, Isaac the Jew was angered to find out he had been tricked into buying a tiny sheep, lamb, actually, through Hadidan's clever words. Isaac then took him to the local judge for redress. While the story didn't show the arbitration, it did include a post-hearing dialogue in which Hadidan had clearly won the case and began moralizing. After revealing Isaac's foolishness, Hadidan taught him and the audience by relating this modified version of the proverb. Matkesh hatatjarab, wamadarab hatatkarab, wamatshri hatatkalab. Don't trust until you try, don't punch until you get close, and don't buy until you check it out. As Bauman has noted, proverbs are a genre we often describe as fixed in nature. However, the moments in which they are deployed, for whom and for what purpose, and in which linguistic form, can tell us a great deal about the discursive work involved in understanding and creating texts in context. Proverbs are an interactional accomplishment that require an audience to perceive of similarities between instances of proverb usage, while recognizing how it fits with the new context, or how the new context relates to previous usages. This metacultural work, making judgments about iconic equivalences between contexts of proverb use, also involves background interactional histories that will vary in mass-mediated mythic storytelling events. The intertextual gaps create a divergence of indexical associations between viewers' and producers' knowledge of spoken genre forms, in this case proverbs, their previous meanings, and the meanings of changes introduced through alliterations to proverb content. As I spoke about Hadidan programs with Moroccans, I found that many audience members who articulated to me on previous occasions that Moroccan life used to be better, more pure, and moral, expressed positive associations with the poetic Hadr al-Mizan form in mythic storytelling, without recognizing the shift from an agrarian social relations skepticism to consumer cash-based consciousness. They were so embedded in the latter context and ideologically attuned to proverbs as fixed genres that the formal reworking seemed unremarkable. While this was a simple example of intertextual gaps arising in mass-mediated interactions, it provides a framework for thinking about the metacultural processes of making equivalences between forms and their contexts of use that will be useful in the subsequent example that I just talk about. Of course, rhymed prose was not only saved for storytelling. I observed it in mobile phone advertising campaigns, by a Radio Aswat call-in dedication program by a guy named Jamal Shlih on Media FM, Medina FM, a human interest television program called Ajit Chouf on Al-Ula, the first station, that highlighted the professional lives of everyday Moroccans engaged in modern occupations, and by television political talk show host Mustafa Al-Alawi in his introduction to former communications minister and ambassador to Italy, Nabil Ben Abdullah. Although I found these use of rhymed prose interesting in these different genres, I never heard or observed Moroccans talking about these as examples of the register. Nobody ever talked about this as an example of Hadr al-Mizan, and they never associated it with wisdom talk or a nostalgic past. And I want to suggest that this may have been because it was not bundled with the multimodal signs of deep meanings that the people began to associate with this particular speech genre and the way it should be spoken. So it wasn't associated with the story genre of speech, or with moral wisdom proverbs, wasn't associated with historical dress or any kind of index of the past. It was not recognized as an example of Hadr al-Mizan talk. Okay, public street storytelling as an interactional genre and vehicle for moral and cultural transmission in Morocco has entailed multiple channels, visual, oral, and aural, right? So both the eye, the mouth, and the ears. It also involved multiple modes of use within each channel. So the oral channel can be used to sing, chant, or speak linguistic features. Visual channel can be used to write, mime, enact, emote story elements, as well as a variety of linguistic codes. So Moroccan Arabic, unmarked French-Arabic code mixing, or tashalhit, tarafit, and tamazight could be used, any of these. Like most other identified registers, speakers who used it coordinated sign systems into a multimodal and multimedia communicative array. They used vocal quality, gesture, dress, bodily comportment, and gaze to create character and modality distinctions. Morality distinctions. Moroccan Arabic includes noun and verb number and gender word endings that make naturally occurring rhymes frequent, even in everyday conversation. As described in ethnographic and biographical accounts, the public street storytelling genre employed the rhymed prose register in creative weaving with other speech styles, such as proverbs, wisdom literature, Quranic quotation, petitionary prayers known as duet, musical jingos, and spontaneous dance performances. And they did so to draw participants into an interactive space known as the halqa, the circle, in which the audience was expected to engage, encourage, respond, and act in relation to the tale and the performer. Street performers and even domestic storytellers, to some extent, might attract an audience through long extensions of a formulaic introduction, brief musical interludes, body humor, event declarations, and directive calls to passersby. A formulaic introduction may have signaled the shift to performance through Hadr al-Mizan, this rhymed prose, and eventually moved into a free-form speaking that occasionally called on the features of rhymed prose to create iconic associations with deep meanings without having to sustain the format throughout the program or throughout their presentation. So as with English fairy tales, there is usually an element of time-space reference, so creating a temporal spatial link between story time and present tellings, the once-upon-a-time frame. In Moroccan Arabic, it was Iwakan, Wamakan, Fakadim Saman. So they have these particular ways that they pronounce this frame, right? So there was a time in the past, in the very old past. And that kind of sets the stage for the story. Back channel comments by the audience were interwoven by the storyteller to create morality moments in the tale. And the end usually involved a collaborative moral evaluation. So I'm now going to turn to the ways in which state storytelling might draw a mass-mediated crowd in order to rework notions about gender equity. There have been a number of Moroccan films since the 1980s whose explicit aim is to raise the image and status of women in the country through positive female characters set in the mythical past. So some examples are Kaidin Set, The Wiles of Women, Aisha Dweeba, Aisha the Fox. The one I'm going to be showing you here is called Romana Wabertal, produced and directed by Boubkadi for Moroccan National Television's Ramadan programming in 2007. The focus was on a Moroccan female trickster, Romana, and her simple cousin, Bartel. The setting was in a southern Moroccan village, often indexical of Tashalhit Berber speakers, yet all the characters spoke Moroccan Arabic, a more widely shared linguistic variety. The heroine was born into poverty and low social rank, but used her cleverness, intelligence, and folk wisdom to succeed in her social and spiritual world. She even tricked the ghouls. The producer conveyed to me that she reversed the moral hierarchies in this tale in order to challenge viewers. The ghoul turns out to have goodness. You didn't expect that. The girl gets out of scrapes and ends up marrying the local judge in a Moroccan version of Cinderella. Television storytelling performance used Ramadan serials advertising clips to draw the audience. So there were these periodic displays before the viewing events to tell people that this was going to happen. And they relied on musical jingles, lyrics, and visual storytelling to engage a non-present audience. While we may think of mass-mediated television as engaging multiple modalities to greater effect, Boubkidi explained that the televisual channel privileged sight, but also constrained the storytelling modalities to the producer's own imagination. Something I heard other Moroccans say as well, that sometimes the television, if you heard something on television, you only got the version that was produced by the producer. You didn't get to create your own mental imaginary of what the story would have been like. This contributed to the re-registering process in that the program writer chose to link new messages about Moroccan civic personhood to the positive associations of moral instruction in Hadra al-Mizan forms, in these rhymed prose forms. Since Hadra al-Mizan forms often included difficult phrases and archaic words, television producers could utilize visual explanatory props to animate the register in ways that face-to-face storytellers could not. As all good storytellers, they could also rework the storylines to convey particular meanings. Boubkidi recounted making a handicapped boy the vehicle for keen, insightful, witty commentary in one of her mythical series in order to invert a widely circulated perception that physical disabilities equate to mental deficiencies. Although the interactions in these serials included non-rhymed phrases, Boubkidi explicitly sought to weave rhymed proverbs, oral wisdom phrases, and rhymed prose dialogues throughout the scenes, explicitly evoking Hadra al-Mizan in boundary moments, such as introduction and closing scenes, and key scene climax moments. In the introduction played at the beginning of every episode, a man's disembodied voice, backed by a single string instrument, signaled the street performance oral mode. The content itself referenced a time before recorded past and explicitly associated social order with mythical morality tales related by elders. In other words, a new generation needed to learn from the proverbs, wisdom, speech styles, and stories not recorded in formal literacy registers but through talk. The introductory metaphors drew on what Flag Miller has called scriptive aesthetics, evoking writing through speech, and Bakhtinian chronotopes, again, these time-space envelopes, indexical envelopes, linguistic envelopes that situate how an interlocutor was to understand an utterance in relation to the present moment. In this case, morality time was constructed with writing references backgrounded. So, got ahead of myself. Okay, so this is a transcript of the opening, the introductory montage. So in the first one, right? So we have had shahel, long ago, right? Long ago. In times before, men registered knowing through pens. Right. So this is a time before writing. Wisdom was not preserved through wooden slates or loha. Which were the ways in which literacy was taught in Morocco. They had these wooden slates that they could write on and then wipe off and then write on again. This index of Moroccan literacy practices in the pre-colonial past, but with speech forms made explicit as genres. By referencing a time before recorded speech, the introduction explicitly associated the social order with morality tales of elders and those who memorized their rhymed prose stories. Yet the irony was that this storytelling event was written as a script and involved participants, the producer, director, actors, camera and lighting technicians, film editors, promotional technicians, etc., whose skills emerged through a series of written and oral literacy practices and events, all of which were backgrounded in the storytelling product. So let's see. Maybe what I'll do is I'll play the... So this is this gives you a sense of some of the transcript. I'm going to play this for you so you can see the actual, this is the second part of it. So this is Romana, the main character.
هذا في حال في أيام زمان قبل ما يتعلم الإنسان يزمن بالأقلام كانوا العقال كيخموا تخمام ينزوا من الخيال حكايات ووهام نظموها في كلام حفظوها الفهام وخلوها ورد من جيال لجيال تبعوا معايا في كل ليلة نصربوا خيوط حكاية وقصة جميلة فعدات الليروة وفهم كلام مقدام
أمانا وبرتال أمانا وبرتال قصة وحديت وحديت واوا وشلا كلام قصة وحديت وحديت واوا وشلا كلام.
Okay, so one of the key things I want to focus on is how Bubkiri used this this Hadr al-Mizan to create these links between the past and the present. She utilized repetition of metered lines for both lyric structure and as a mnemonic aid, but also to iconically demonstrate the practices of storytelling, in which tales are told repeatedly. In addition, she relied on Arabic cognate accusatives, or grammatical structures that employ a verb followed by an object noun derived from the same verb. She used these cognate accusatives for both poetic effect and to aid understanding of archaic terms in which the noun form may have been more known in contemporary usage than the verb form. Despite the overall frame of an idealized past, Bubkiri wrote the script employing habitual aspect verbs, in which the action was ongoing and incomplete, constructing a timelessness to these practices and their relevance. The intervisual and chronotopic program precursor to Hadr al-Mizan, mentioned previously, the adult literacy program called Alif Lam, narrated by Naima Lamsharki, provided a format for switching between storytelling rhymed introductions and poetic conversation enactments. As part of the enregistrement process, Alif Lam's language style and settings offered indexical frames for a nostalgic mythical past, domestic space, and storytelling as moral genre. Bubkiri's opening montage created a new transmission link for these oral tales through intervisuality, drawing visual and discursive associations together. The key was educating a new generation, no longer as widely socialized to this register, through the fusing of television's cinema visual storytelling as cue to these rhymed prose meanings. She illustrated the lyrical meter with a montage from series episodes. The deep meanings of the genre were made explicit through the introduction in both the rhymed form and content. New generations need to learn from the proverbs, speech styles, and stories recorded not in formal registers or wooden slates, but through talk produced by someone they could not respond to. In this example and analysis of state television-sponsored programs, producers employed Moroccan rhymed prose and rhythmic speech to convey a mix of nostalgia for the ways in which wisdom was imparted in the past and contemporary educated elite values about how modern citizens should think and act. However, a key question remains. How did a subset of the target Moroccan audiences, presumed masses who needed an education in modern civic values, respond to these storytelling efforts at state storytelling? Even though there was a presumed indexical selectivity, right, the mass-mediated medium of television allowed for any number of possible viewers, including myself. Did mobilizing the particular visual and storytelling affordances of television increase absorption of the intended values and beliefs? Did Moroccans identify these civic virtues when framed in an old linguistic form coupled with state-of-the-art technologies? I began observing responses to these television programs in 2004 while doing fieldwork on media reception practices among Moroccan families living in urban Fez. Of course, television talk occurred not just in viewing moments, but both preceding and subsequent to program airings, in taxis, buses, service encounters, workplaces, and homes. It was part of the interactional norms for small talk in Moroccan life. Sometimes I initiated commentary from my Moroccan interlocutors, whether they be elites, producers, educated, and undereducated viewers. At other moments, these emerged in the flow of everyday exchanges. Part of what I observed was the way in which viewing practices reflected an implicit media ideology about television. Most of the families who graciously allowed me to observe and record their television engagements did not see viewing as an activity in and of itself. Television was the background to social interactions, a potential interlocutor in group discussion, but the focus was on being attentive to and orienting to one's present family members and friends. In fact, as I reviewed my field notes of television talk, I encountered a common critique of people who aish or live in television programs, who become too involved in following a serialized program or a film at the expense of their other interlocutors. One way this media ideology was articulated to me was that the television served as one contributor in an ongoing, emergent, and dynamic interaction. Sometimes the program content, style, and language was foregrounded by family members and at other times backgrounded in the flow of everyday meals, homework, talk about the day, political debates, and gossip. With that in mind, I turned to my ethnographic accounts of viewer responses to Hadhrami Mizan programming. I observed not a single family who watched these programs attentively all the way through. None. Individuals followed content more closely than others, but since every family I knew placed the television in the salon that doubled as a dining room and sleeping quarters, disruptions from meals and cross-conversations and activities that occurred at the same time as television programs were the norm. Even when the focus was on relaxing through watching television, whoever had the remote control rarely left the television on a single channel all the way through a scene, as other family members may ask them to find something more interesting or provide an evaluative comment that would spark a discussion. As an illustration, one evening as I sat with a mother, whom I'm calling Zahra, her 40-year-old sister, Latifa, and two daughters, the younger 15-year-old daughter held the remote and was channel surfing during a lull in their conversation. After the 8 p.m. news, there was a series of ads for upcoming public events, the Mawazine Pop Music Festival in Rabat and a comedy festival in Marrakesh, which featured French-Moroccan actor-comedian Jamal Debbouze. No one paid attention to these ads except to agree that public intellectuals protesting and criticizing the state's investments in festivals that bring in foreign talent only had one valid point. Money should not be spent on all these festivals when there were so many unemployed and poor. While we could hear the sounds of the father and brother praying in the other room, Latifa asked if the Moroccan series episode rerun that just came on was from Romana Wabortal. Zahra said yes, and the 15-year-old daughter said no, it was Hadidan, and then claimed that she had never watched a single episode. The mother asked where the remote was and then said, let's watch something better than this, and changed it to a transnational Saudi-funded religious station, Iqra, with a religious lecture on proper ways to care for one's elderly parents. A week later, I was with the same mother and her 30-year-old son when we went to visit her brother and sister-in-law one evening. As we sat around visiting, drinking tea and talking politics and family news, the television was on in the other salon, entertaining her brother's toddler children. As Zahra's brother talked about the unemployment problem in Morocco, he relied on quotes he explicitly stated he learned from watching a state television news magazine program. At one point, the conversation shifted to a discussion about how much Crown Prince Moulay Hassan followed Hadidan, one of Boubkiri's programs, such that, as was reported in Moroccan television, according to the uncle, he gave a much-coveted lifetime taxi license to the main actors and had his picture taken with them. They all then began to discuss how much they liked the idea of Hadidan and similar serials, like Romana Wabortal and Aisha Dawiba, though they all admitted not watching them. Zahra's brother's wife mentioned how much she appreciated the presentation of Moroccan heritage, which she further glossed as the Moroccan proverbs and folktales in these programs. She stated that no one else was preserving their heritage like Boubkiri in her series. From the majority of these encounters and conversations, I identified little recognition that television producers were altering proverb content and folktales to convey values the educated producers believed were necessary for an informed and enlightened citizenry, despite the growing number of regional radio programs devoted to explicating and discussing the meaning of Moroccan proverbs. However, that did not mean that the intentions of producers utilizing Hadhrami Mizan and their programming to convey modernist values were entirely missing their mark. Their message resonated with those who shared the same values. One evening, as I sat eating dinner in the home of a successful Fassi businessman and his family, the discussion turned to Hadidan, how much this man, his mother-in-law, and 10-year-old son enjoyed the programming. This family self-aligned with a cosmopolitan educated Islam and collaboratively constructed a happy response that these programs discouraged folk magic at the same time as valorizing their traditional past. My presentation today is a fragment from a chapter in a larger ethnography on the intersection of media ideologies and language ideologies in Moroccan political projects involving state television. It is also shaped by the Moroccans who allowed me to observe their viewing practices, to elicit their media and language ideologies, and to share their indexical loadings. As such, this account is partial, multiple, and positioned, just as the ideologies I analyze. Yet they hint at ways in which we might understand media ideologies and language ideologies in Moroccan state storytelling. Media ideologies, observed both explicitly in television talk as well as implicitly in viewing practices, were key to understanding what meanings traveled with the rhymed prose when it moved from public, street, and domestic storytelling to state storytelling. For television producers, the use of televisual storytelling techniques with a Moroccan intangible cultural heritage register facilitated its translatability for generations producers and many audience adults felt were no longer socialized to understand the deep meanings of rhymed prose. The state's appropriation of this genre was an attempt to legitimate modernization projects, reinforcing a modernization for media ideology, and demonstrate the state's moral authenticity. Or to quote the late Moroccan philosopher Mohamed Abdel Jabri, to seek our modernity by rethinking our tradition. For many audience members, the preservation of this communicative heritage was more significant than any message embedded in the actual content, which many did not attend to directly because of an implicit media ideology that emerged from media use. The iconic valence of Hadr al-Mizan's deep sounds could be grasped without having to watch the whole program. Just as alternative possibilities for intextualization come through print technologies, state-sponsored media capitalized on the enregistrement potential of television in the drive to modernize Moroccan citizens. Through the creation of chronotopic equivalences and visual storytelling, Hadr al-Mizan producers revalorized the form to authenticate state television's media and development ideology. The circulation of this form was not new, from homes to markets to cultural festivals and then to media culture. Nor was the commoditized labor, but what was new were the ends to which it was employed and the associated visualizations of modern personhood involved in furthering those aims through state storytelling. As a linguistic anthropologist, the intended audience evaluations that were most telling for me included a reinforcing notion that previous generations were more clever than the current generations because they spoke with wisdom and rhythm. Several people explicitly articulated their pleasure that new generations would know the multimodal performance of wisdom through rhyme, yet they did not articulate adhering to the modernist meanings conveyed by producers in the same form. I suggest that the moral of this tale may be that mediums are only part of the message, because they too are part of indexical bundles that allow for multiple means to understand what those ends might be. Thank you.
We now invite Sonia Das as discussant to come up.
All right. Well, thank you, Janice, for inviting me, and thank you, Becky, for a fascinating talk. All right. So in the early history of anthropology as a four-field Americanist discipline, the study of storytelling served as a bridge between linguistic anthropologists who were interested in the formal and poetic features of stories and culture anthropologists and folklorists who are perhaps more interested in the performative content and role of stories and myths in religious and social life. Since the 1960s and 1970s, when ethnographers first highlighted the interactive dynamics of storytelling as a genre mediated by social practice, both cultural and linguistic anthropologists have paid closer attention to its participation frameworks. Inquiring into how stories are enacted and reenacted across different social spaces, historical periods, channels, and mediums, these studies have sought to understand how belief systems and social identities are produced and reproduced through spoken and written communication involving story and narrative. More recently, scholars of language and media, upon noticing that face-to-face and mass-mediated communication share some of the same multimodal properties, yet differ in their material constraints, have sought to compare talk about media with talk in media through ethnographic studies of reception practices. Because storytelling and other narrative devices figure prominently in media programming, determining which linguistic forms are made conspicuous and which become inconspicuous goes a long way in making sense of the ideologies and political projects associated with mass media in regional and global markets. So this brings me to Becky Schulte-Theis, fascinating discussion of the conspicuous use of Hadr al-Mizan, or rhyme prose, in Moroccan didactic televisual programming. by interweaving theory and linguistic anthropology with an ethnographic media reception study of television viewing, Schulteis showcases the partial successes and partial failures of a state-sponsored modernization project. Specifically, by comparing the media and language ideologies of producers, viewers, and commentators, Schulteis traces changes in the meanings and messages attached to an interactive street performance genre of rhymed storytelling that is historically associated with ancient wisdom, morality, rural life, and, quote, deep meaning. This evocative genre was adapted by the Moroccan state for use in radio programming in the 1980s and then television programming in the late 1990s and 2000s to teach literacy, gender equity, and civic responsibility to the masses. Now, due to its widespread use in mass media, rhymed prose is more generally recognized as an emblematic register of the wise and moral speakers of long ago. Ironically, both casual viewers and non-viewers who are only superficially acquainted with the content of these television serials largely ignore the state's modernization message and instead simply appreciate these shows for preserving Moroccan Berber oral heritage. This misreception, Schulteis argues, highlights a type of media ideology about participation frameworks. Namely, television characters in state-sponsored serials count as one among many ratified interlocutors involved in everyday conversations about moral personhood and model citizenship in contemporary Morocco. So people in the past were cleverer in their ways of talking and solving problems than people in the present, Schulteis informants say, in a way that sort of implicitly equates contemporary social problems with media-driven changes in communicative practices. On the other hand, television producers regard new media technologies as introducing different constraints and possibilities for using multimodal communication for education and social improvement. Whereas the ability to record proverbs and write scripted tales is not quite as clever as the ability to memorize them and reproduce them orally in face-to-face interactions as people once did in the past, producers are happy to script visual scenes that, in conjunction with rhyming prose, can be used to devise morality tales with modern themes, stressing the importance of literacy, civic participation, diversity, and problems of magic. These messages resonate well with a small, urban, and Islamic audience. Most of Schulteis's informants do not watch these shows, however, even if they mention them in small talk. In these daily conversations, both viewers and non-viewers express their gratitude toward filmmakers for using a distinctly Moroccan stylistic genre to assert their national identity in a television market that is increasingly saturated by transnational producers working only in modern standard Arabic, but I'm not actually sure about that, but say maybe working mostly in modern standard Arabic. So lest we forget why rhyming prose is such a powerful means for Moroccans to assert their national identity, Schulteis explains that Moroccan Arabic has certain verb and gender endings that lend easily to rhyming and assonance. Conversations often break into rhyme, to borrow an expression of Delheim's, and act as contextualization cues signaling that these phrases might possess a deeper meaning. Collectively, these performative breakthroughs also contribute to a speech register associated with the wise and moral people of long ago. When used in television serials, this register situates the characters of narrated stories with scenes of an idyllic past. Narrative voiceovers then use habitual tense markers to convey a timeless didactic stance. Schulteis' discussion of these discursive and grammatical features, along with the show's visual elements, explains how the Moroccan state can produce transcendent messages of morality that connect traditional motifs of oral storytelling, such as rural life and domestic space, with those of televisual storytelling, such as contemporary urban life and consumer culture. Schulteis's analysis thus contributes to linguistic anthropology's long-abiding interest in understanding the dialectic relationship between grammatical forms, communicative practices, and language and other semiotic ideologies. So I'm also intrigued by some of the apparent contradictions and inconsistencies in Moroccan television programming. For example, characters in television serials often talk about recorded tales and written stories as being less worthy of national veneration than oral storytelling. So I wonder, doesn't this message somehow downplay the educational importance of scripted television serials? And is this partly the reason why most Moroccans are not interested in watching these shows? Or are there other more compelling reasons for them to switch channels? Also, how does the reception of state-sponsored shows fare among citizens living outside of urban Fez, which is where you did most of your research? Are rural or urban folk the primary target audiences, what's seen as this undereducated masses? And finally, I would love to learn more about how these shows depict the status of Moroccan Arabic and modern standard Arabic through, say, dialogue and voiceover. And if you recall, the female storyteller on that show, Alif Lam, tells us that characters speaking in Moroccan Arabic are seen as more authentic in conveying a national identity. If that's true, then why do viewers still prefer the transnationally produced shows in modern standard Arabic? So what exactly are Moroccan attitudes towards these different varieties of Arabic, and how do these attitudes impact production in regional and transnational media markets? Finally, I'm keen to learn more about what Moroccans think about the past. So which period or periods in history are fondly remembered or imagined as idyllic, and by whom and why? Also, are there different genres of storytelling associated with different historical periods in Morocco? These questions are inspired by Keith Basso's 1996 monograph, Wisdom Sits in Places, which describes four major genres of narrative used by the Western Apache, each associating a specific time scale or a historical period with a participation framework and didactic or entertaining message. So medicine men and women perform myths dealing with events occurring at the beginning of time, and these are intended for general enlightenment and instruction about the origins of the world. Historical tales instead deal with events from, quote, long ago, which is just prior to and just after the arrival of the white man, and their purpose is to edify and criticize social delinquents. Sagas are concerned with events occurring in modern times or the past 60 or 70 years and are intended for relaxation and entertainment. Whereas gossip are reports of events involving other members of the Western Apache community and are always based in the present. And their purpose is to ridicule or malign the character of local people. Can similar distinctions be found among storytelling genres in Morocco that construct alternative visions of the relationship between the past and the present? And if so, how does media programming complicate these generic distinctions? In closing, I want to emphasize that storytelling and Hadra al-Nizam are seen as endangered resources by Moroccans. Like most other heritage work, however, institutionalized efforts to preserve languages or linguistic styles do not always intend to revitalize them for everyday use. For some, it is enough that their languages and language practices will be memorialized for future posterity. Moreover, in the case of Morocco, state-sponsored efforts to preserve rhyme prose through televisual storytelling also helps to disseminate didactic messages and modernization to the masses and carve out a niche for Moroccan producers within a transnational media market. Becky Schulteis's ethnographic study of Moroccan television reveals these dynamics by effectively combining the analysis of narrative, poetics, and media production and reception. Also, by demonstrating the efficacy of storytelling in social and political life, Schulteis's work itself contributes to a venerable tradition of collaborative scholarship in cultural and linguistic anthropology. Thank you.
I'll invite you up, Becky, to field questions, if you like.